Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is a project that's been going on at Microsoft Research for a while, so I'm going to talk about this project, which is called Pasture. We were fortunate to have great interns over the years who have graduated since and are working at various places. So this is joint work with them as well as our colleagues at Microsoft Research. There seems to be a trade-off between mobility and security in the applications that we are building today, especially when the client is not trusted. On one hand, we have thin client applications where the data is stored on the server all the time, and it's accessed only when the user accesses the data. This is good in terms of security because the data is protected by the server and it knows when the client accessed it. On the other hand, it's bad in terms of mobility because if the server is disconnected, then it cannot access the data offline. On the other end of the spectrum, we have rich client applications where the data is transferred to the client device even before the user accesses it. And this approach is good in terms of mobility because now that enables user to do disconnected operations. But it comes at the cost of security because now the server has no control on the data and there's no way of knowing if the client has accessed the data or not. In this work, we are fundamentally asking the question whether we can break this trade-off between security and mobility and provide both. Specifically, can we provide secure offline data access? So to motivate this work with a real-world example, we have offline video services where they allow you to download a bunch of movies, and they allow you to watch them even when you're offline. That's great. But there is a small catch to that, is that you have to pay for what you download and not for what you watch. This is basically for the reason that the server has no way of knowing whether the client has accessed the data or not. Wouldn't it be nice if we have a better and rich offline video service where you could download a bunch of movies when you're on the airport, when you have connection, watch some when you're flying, when you get back, get refunded for the other movies that you didn't watch. At the core of this problem, there is a problem of secure offline data access, which is not only applicable to the application that has shown you, but also in other areas. The problem being that in order to provide offline access, you want to download a bunch of data before the user accesses it, and let the user make a decision offline to access it or not when he's even when he's not connected to the server. And when he comes back online, the server should be able to tell what data he has accessed and if he hasn't accessed the data or not. There are two challenges to solve this problem. One is, how do you ensure that the user hasn't accessed the data in the past, especially when you don't trust the user or the application that the user is using, OS or the hypervisor? And the second is, even if the user doesn't lie about the past accesses, how do you ensure that the future accesses to the revoked data is ensured, especially when the user has access to both the data bits as well as the encryption and the decryption keys? How do you ensure that? So to solve this problem, we propose Pasture. Before I get into the details as to how we provide secure offline access, I just want to first talk to you about the Pasture system itself and the properties that it provides, the system model and the assumptions that we make before going into how we provide secure offline access and how we make it practical. So what is Pasture? Pasture is a messaging and logging library where a sender and receiver can exchange keys during the data transfer mode, where the sender in the video service application was the video service provider, the receiver being the client device. In the second phase, it allows the users to access or revoke the data even when they're offline, so allowing them to do some offline actions. And then in the third phase, when they get back online, the server can audit the client device and know if the data is being accessed or not. In order to provide secure offline accesses, we provide specifically two properties. The first one being access and deniability. This is to meet the first challenge of preventing a user from lying about past accesses. This property is more specifically, if a user accesses some data sent by a correct sender, then the user cannot lie about it without failing the audit. I want you to stress on two points, which is that without failing the data, what I mean by that is if the user is disconnected, we cannot make any predictions on whether the user accessed the data or not, because we don't know. And the other one is on the obtaining access. We can only say whether the data is being accessed or not, or in particular, whether the decryption key to the data has been possessed by the user or not. And we cannot say anything about whether the application has viewed the data or how many times the user has viewed the data. The second property that we provide is to meet the second challenge, which is to prevent users from accessing the revoked data in future. And this property in particularly provides verifiable proof of revocation to the sender so that the sender can verify that the data has been revoked and the user did not or cannot access the data ever in future. And the two points to note here is that we not only should guarantee that the data was not accessed, but it will never be accessed in future. The other property being that we should be able to provide a proof of revocation to the sender so that sender can be satisfied that the data has been revoked. In fact, the data has been revoked. So it would be nice if we could provide these properties without trusting anything on the client device, but unfortunately we cannot. So the next question that we ask is, how can we lower the TCB? So what do we trust? So we do not trust the user or his actions. We do not trust the application that is accessing the data or the OS or the hypervisor that's running on that. However, we trust certain trusted hardware. The first being the trusted platform module, which is a cryptographic coprocessors that are shipped in many PCs these days, including my 3-year-old laptop. We also trust processor extensions for securely launching and executing trusted code in isolation from malicious OS. So Intel and AMD have instruction extensions to do that. Intel's, it's called Trusted Execution Technology, and AMD has its own. We also trust a small amount of code that runs inside this trusted execution, a secure execution mode. Now that I've told you what Pasture is, I would like to show you how we provide secure offline access. So as I told you, there are two actors in our system. One is the sender, the other is the receiver. Sender in the video application example is the server, which is providing the video data, and the receiver being the client device. So in the first phase, the sender exchanges keys with the receiver and sends the encrypted data. In the second phase, when the receiver is offline, he can choose to access or revoke the data. And in the third phase, when the sender comes back online, the receiver comes back up online, the sender could audit the data and verify if the data has been accessed or not. Now, let me go into each of these three phases and show you how we guarantee the two properties. I'll do it in the reverse order just for simplicity, and then I'll go over the protocol in an end-to-end fashion. So for the audit purpose, in order to ensure audit, first we need to have a mechanism to log user actions securely. And second, we should have a mechanism to prevent users from providing stale logs and try to get around the properties that we provide. So how do we do that? We use a mechanism called tamper-evident append-only log to provide these two properties. It essentially consists of two components. One is an untrusted disk on which you store the entire log, and then we use TPM to store a small summary of the log. Before I get into how we build this tamper-evident log, I want to give you a short summary of TPM and the properties that we use. TPM, is, as I said, is a cryptographic coprocessor. It can do certain cryptographic operations like signing and encryption and decryption. Apart from that, it has some limited non-volatile RAM, and it has some limited number of registers which are called platform control registers. These registers are special in a way that you can only update using some certain cryptographic operations. So on a reboot, these registers are initialized to a well-known values, either 0 or 1, depending on which registers you have. And then you can only update these registers by cryptographically extending a value to it. In this case, when you extend value E1, it takes the current value of that PCR, in this case PCR 0, which is a value, and then appends E1 to it and generates a SHA-1 and writes the value back to the PCR 1. So PCR 1 is the value of that PCR after the first extension. And once you do, if you do one more extension on that E2, you would get another value similar to that. The point to note here is that the PCR maintains a hash summary of all the past extensions. And this property we are going to use to provide tamper-evident log, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But the other point to remember is once a PCR is extended, it is not possible to roll back if there are no reboots. I'm going to talk about reboots later, but for now, let's assume that there are no reboots. And extend with a different value. So in this case, once you extended the value E2 to take to PCR2 state, you cannot extend, go back to PCR1 and extend it to other value PCR2 prime. And from the hash collision resistance properties of the SHA-1, we assume that it's not possible to diverge the state once a value is committed, extended. So given that property, it is very straightforward, and there are standard ways to do that, and many existing systems have already done that, so we use a similar mechanism. So when user makes an offline action, we store his action on untrusted disk, which is shown by the log on the right, and we also extend the PCR with the hash of that value. So as we, so when the user accesses the video, that's logged into the log, and then it's also extended in the PCR. So by storing the chain hash summary of the log, we ensure that the user, the malicious user, does not evict entries in the untrusted log that it has, because the by reading the PCR value, you can detect that. Other than that, we also, to ensure the freshness so that the malicious receiver does not send a stale log, we have an audit process whereby you can send a nonce to the receiver's TPM and ask the TPM to code the current value along with the nonce assigned current value. By using non-migratable keys, you can be ensured that the log, whatever the log that the sender is receiving, is a fresh one. So this ensures the two properties for the audit. Now I go to the second phase where the user does offline actions. So I just provided you a mechanism where user cannot tamper with the log, but how do you ensure that user? How do you force the receiver to log the events to begin with, his offline actions to begin with? So for this, we propose a mechanism called bound key primitive. TPMs allow you to generate our encryption-decryption key pairs, RSA key pairs, where the decryption key is bound to a value in a PCR, which means that unless the PCR has that value, you cannot access the decryption key to decrypt any data. Now we use that property of TPM to bind our encryption decryption key to a specific value in the future. In this case, if you are going to send encrypted data, we are first going to bind the key to the current value of the PCR appended by the hash of the data that we are going to send before we actually encrypt the data and send. So what this means is that for the receiver to access the data, he needs to access the decryption key. In order to access the decryption key, he has to extend the PCR state from its current state by extending with hash of the data. By doing so, he has implicitly logged the event. Hence, the user is forced to log the access to the data. Conversely, he can extend the data to a different state, which in this case, delta, which is different from hash of the data, and revoke the access. And permanently revoke the access to the key. So that provides you the revocation property. So let's see how these two offline bound key primitive works with our protocol. So in the first phase, the sender is going to send a get key message with the hash of the data, and the receiver is going to generate this bound key in its TPM and sends the encryption key where the decryption key is bound to the future value. The sender is going to encrypt the data and send it back to the receiver. Receiver can now go offline, and if it chooses to access the data, it extends the PCR value with the hash of the data to get access to the decryption key. By doing so, it cannot. The action is permanently logged. Hence, we provide access undeniability. If it chooses to revoke the data, it extends with a special value which is different from the hash of the data, in which case the user access is permanently revoked. Note that once the state diverges, you can't go back and change it. Hence, it's permanently revoked in future. So this provides access to undeniability and also revocation. But what I haven't told you is that how does the sender know that the key is actually bound to the right value? And how does the receiver generate the proof of revocation to convince the sender that it has indeed revoked the key when it did? So for this, we use a mechanism called attested execution. So the TPMs provide a primitive called transport session, wherein all the operations within the session are logged and signed by the TPM. Hence, if you generate the keys within that session, the receiver can get a signed log from the TPM that it has generated the key, and now the sender can verify that the key is bound to the right value before sending the encrypted data. Apart from that, we use the proof of bound key generation along with the proof that the PCR has diverged from current state to a different state to generate a proof of revocation using the same mechanism as audit. Which uses the TPM code. So now that I've talked about all three phases, let me do an end-to-end review of the protocol for the same example. I'll go back to this example. So in this case, before the service provider sends a movie, it sends a hash of the movie and asks for the get key message. The receiver generates the bound key and sends the encryption key along with the proof of key generation. Sender verifies that the key is indeed bound to the right value. It encrypts the key and sends the encrypted version of the movie to the receiver. Receiver can now go offline, can access the data by extending the PCR with the hash of the movie, in which case the access is logged, or it can revoke the access by extending with a different value. At a later time, when it comes back online, the sender can now do an audit on the receiver to find out whether it has watched the movie or not by sending a nonce. The receiver is going to send the full log along with the signed PCR value, and the sender can verify if the movie is being watched. If it's not watched, then it can verify the proof of revocation, and if the proof of revocation passes, it can give the refund for the movies that it didn't watch. So those are the three key mechanisms that we use to provide secure offline access. Now let me talk about some of the practical issues that we had to overcome in order to make it practical. So the paper has all the details. Here I'm going to summarize just the issues and the solution at a high level as to how we get around those issues. The first being the PCRs are volatile. So how do you prevent rollback attacks where a malicious receiver could access a movie and then reboot the system, initialize the PCR, and take the PCR to a state prior to watching the movie and then can deny the access? In order to prevent this attack, we use a mechanism that's introduced by Flickr, which uses the secure execution mode to run trusted code in isolation from untrusted OS or hypervisor. So we use this secure execution mechanism to checkpoint the PCR before shutdown and recover the PCR value, to checkpoint the PCR into the non-volatile RAM of the TPM before shutdown, and recover the value from the NVRAM during the reboot process. But how do we ensure that the user actually runs these two mechanisms, these two methods? We do that by binding keys not only to the application PCR that we presented before, but also to the successful execution of recovery, of which event will be logged into a special PCR that logs the trusted code that runs in secure execution mode. The second one is the protocol that I've shown you just shows you one message, one transfer. So there could be multiple senders, and so how do you take care of that? So for that, we use multiple PCRs to have multiple logs. Apart from that, within a given log, we can do speculative ordering of events in future to generate keys. And given that it can be exponential to the number of concurrent events, it's only practical if we have a limited speculation. We talk more in the paper. We use auditing to truncate the log, and we use audit certificates to do that. We also, given that the TPM have limited non-volatile cycles, we minimize NVRAM and NV counter operations and SEM operations for that, in order to reduce, in order to not only reduce overhead but also to extend the lifetimes. This also improves user interaction and utilization, of course, because in the secure execution mode, you have to disable interrupts and other codes to prevent untrusted OS from gaining control while you are executing the trusted code. We build upon a lot of work that's being done on using trusted code. Here, I just name a few, but the paper has a comprehensive comparison of our work with others. So Flickr is the first one which came up with this approach of using secure execution mode to run trusted code in isolation from untrusted OS. Memvoir built on top of that to provide to prevent rollback attacks. Trink. So both of these mechanisms allow to run generalized state machines in the trusted code. In Trink, it provides limited functionality of a test, and it uses a different approach. Pasture specifically provides secure offline access using trusted computing, trusted hardware. So we use Flickr for secure execution of checkpoint and recovery. However, Flickr is not resilient to crashes. If there is a reboot, it can result in state discontinuity. So Memvoir addresses that approach by providing state continuity and also preventing rollback attacks. However, since it runs the trusted code in SEM, the interrupts are always disabled. Instead, Pasture does not run access or revoke operation in secure execution mode. Hence, interrupts and cores are not disabled. And also, it does not, like Memvoir, it does not do NV update operations. Trink, on the other hand, has to do NV update operations for every attestation, and which reduces the lifetime of the device. So we built Pasture on Windows machines, on different machines with different TPMs. We have this library which can be linked into any application. We built a plugin that links into this library and provides that acts as a transport layer to exchange keys, and also provides a UI interface for other applications that are built on top. So now we use this plugin to exchange keys, symmetric keys, encrypted symmetric keys for the video service mock-up application, and also secure email that we provide for health applications, where you can revoke emails after being delivered to accidentally delivered to unauthorized receivers. So now let me briefly give you the overheads that are imposed by Pasture. I'll just have one graph on this. The paper has more evaluation. The first operation that I want to talk about is the create key, which is the most expensive operation, which takes about 4 seconds. Almost all of this overhead is incurred due to the create key overhead within the TPM. Given that this is being used during the data transfer mode, it does not affect much for the video application, where the latencies are incurred by transferring the movie itself, or in the secure email, where this is done in the background. So this can be hidden from user perceived latency The other operation, seal, checkpoint, and recovery, is about 1 second. And given that these are executed rather uncommon only during boots and shutdown and reboot, the overheads are acceptable. For offline actions where you access data or revoke data, for revocation, we take as low as 24 milliseconds to 40 milliseconds, depending on the TPM.
for accessing, it can be up to 0.5, about a half a second. Again, for a movie application where you have to decrypt the movie, this overhead is not much. So I started off this talk by saying that there seems to be a trade-off between these two worlds, and Pasture tries to bridge these two worlds by providing secure offline access. In particular, we provide access and deniability when you access the data, and verifiable revocation when you revoke your data on your device. And the key mechanism for this is a bound key primitive that we use. Thank you.
Questions? So I had one question.
Sure.
What happens if you crash in the middle of the checkpoint routine? What kinds of guarantees will Pasture provide depending on the point of the crash?
So if it crashes in between, we don't provide liveness. So we are stuck, but we don't allow the user to continue. So now the keys are unusable. So the user cannot continue that. So we assume that there is some application level recovery for that. So if you, but we ensure safety.
Thanks.
Yeah, Rick. Oh. Rick Farrow. But this is all for Intel-based platforms, and almost all mobile devices are ARM-based. So, do you think there's any future for this, really, or are you just depending on the mobile world somehow moving to Intel platforms?
ARM provides something called Trusted Zones. I'm not very familiar with Trusted Zone technology, but we haven't explored that, so I cannot say whether you can provide the same guarantees or not, but we would like to do that and look at that in future.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Evgeny? My question might be naive, but what if you download video to the hard drive, then make a carbon copy of this hard drive, and go offline, then watch videos, then plug another hard drive where you have, like, clean?
So, as I said, if I understand your question correctly, in the access and deniability property, all we can say is whether you accessed the movie or not. What you do with that once you access it, or in fact, once you access the decryption key, we cannot guarantee that. You can copy, you can do whatever you want, or we cannot guarantee anything on that. This problem is there even in the online world. So this seems, we think that it's an orthogonal problem, and we don't address that.
So theoretically, it's possible to watch movie and then get refund, basically.
No, he can't do that.
Even if you replace hard drive and stuff?
No, once you watch movie, it's logged in the tamper evident log. So when you audit, it's apparent to the sender. So you won't get refund for that.
But, I mean, this log would be offline on the hard drive. And then you plug another hard drive, which is exactly like this, where you watch. And that log isn't untampered yet.
It would fail the audit. So you won't get the refund.
Okay.
Hi, Kevin Walsh from Holy Cross. Could I ask about your the access control check that you do is whether the PCR is equal to the desired value or it's diverged.
Yeah.
So that gives you sort of a very limited kind of policy, and I understand that you do some tricks for multiplexing for multiple objects or multiple senders,
sure,
I guess.
Sure.
And does that come from a limitation in the TPM, that it can only bind keys to specific values rather than a predicate?
Right now, yes, you can only do a specific value rather than a predicate.
So my question is, why aren't you using the TXT, the trusted execution, to provide more interesting access control policies? You can imagine a whole sorts of interesting predicates that you might want to do where you can access one object, and once you access it, you can no longer access other objects or any sorts of things. Is it just that you don't want to use TXT?
It's not that. As I show in this, we could have used Flickr to provide the same properties. But there are three disadvantages with that. If you're running in secure execution mode, you have to disable interrupts and cores.
But for a movie, disabling interrupts for 3 seconds for at the beginning is not a big deal.
Yeah, but even if it is smaller, it affects user interactivity. The other is it does not provide, it's vulnerable to the Snoop attacks. So now if the attacker can look into, use a cold boot attack to get the keys out of the memory, then he can decode the key without logging it. So in our case, by binding the keys in a specific way, we prevent even the Snoop attacks. So.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, let's thank Rama again.